Okay, any preliminary issues or questions? Okay, well, we return to chapter 2 on causation, and we had that introductory section or case to try to give you an overall big picture view of the issues. And again, we're dividing this into two separate sort of questions, both of which have to be answered in the affirmative in order for the plaintiff to meet the burden of proximate cause. The first test is whether the injury is one without which, whether the defendant's conduct, negligence or strict liability, is a cause without which the injury would not have occurred. Call it but-for cause. Later we'll look at the second half of the proximate cause test, whether it is also a legal cause of the injury. Okay, to get us going on this but-for cause requirement, we have Hull versus Merck and Company. Ms. McGrain, can you tell us about Hull? It's actually an illustration of where you could assert a strict liability theory in place of a negligence theory, but with respect to causation, the question is the same. What's the question before the House here?
Is whether they should be held liable based on the evidence because his expert witness isn't really sure or not.
Okay, so the question before the House is, assuming what they did was negligent or was subject to strict liability,
did it cause?
Yes, did this exposure to the chemicals cause his injury? And again, it sort of raises the fundamental question of, you may have heard the expression, the post hoc propter hoc fallacy. After that, because of that. And again, my friend in college who erroneously assumed that because her father's death followed this wrestling on the living room floor, that caused his death. So we don't want to make the post hoc propter hoc fallacy. He was exposed to these chemicals, he got leukemia. But what tells us that the exposure caused his leukemia? And that, in turn, gets us to the specifics of how he presented that evidence at trial. To persuade the jury that the exposure to the chemicals caused his leukemia, what did he do? Yes, and again, this is a common feature of modern tort litigation. You've heard the expression, a battle of the experts. So that you have people who are trained in some scientific field, whether it's DNA testing or environmental chemical exposure or setting bones or cardiology or whatever engineering, whatever their specialty is, they come in and testify for the plaintiff, or they testify for the defendant, and a key issue in the case seems to be in the hands of these experts who are battling over, the details of some complex technical issue. I sometimes refer to the pool of experts relied upon by the plaintiff as 1-800-EXPERT. In fact, there is, I'll see if I can find the brochure. I regularly get a brochure from a group called the Technical and Scientific Advisory Board. And while it isn't 1-800-EXPERT, they do have an 800 line, and it's sent out to lawyers saying, in effect, if you need an expert on A to Z, you know, from aardvarks to zebras, they've got an expert on one of these subjects. And as the expression goes, you know, you put enough quarters into the jukebox and eventually it'll play the song you want to hear. In areas where we do need technical assistance to understand the problem, the big issue is, when does this testimony satisfy the requirements of our justice system, and when is the testimony not worth listening to? Okay, there's a sort of a little procedural wrinkle here. When the case gets to trial, what does the plaintiff offer by way of testimony? It's the form of the testimony I was looking for here. They don't actually have this guy testifying live. Ms. Beard? Yeah, this again is another feature of modern tort litigation, that much of the work of tort litigation occurs in pretrial preparation. Many of you have had your deposition taken as witnesses to or as parties in some kind of a lawsuit, and the testimony is under oath. The difference is you don't have a judge ruling on the admissibility of the evidence. You, except for the form of the question, you basically let people give whatever testimony they want under oath, and then at trial you determine what of this testimony is admissible and what is not. Now, for reasons not made clear, instead of bringing this witness live, the plaintiff offers this deposition testimony. And what is the substance of the testimony in the deposition that the plaintiff wants to rely on? Actually, that's the part the defendant brings up. The part the plaintiff brings up is, the sort of bottom line, that the exposure to the chemicals caused the leukemia. And that by itself seems to satisfy, okay, here's an expert who claims to know about this stuff and says, in my professional opinion, based on my review of the evidence, I believe that this exposure caused his injury. Now, the jury might find that credible or might not, but that seems to satisfy our standard. However, the defendant, the defendant's lawyer, says, gee, I'm very interested in this, doctor. Let me find out some more about how you came to this conclusion. And that's where we find out about these two assumptions. And what are those two assumptions? The doctor says, I believe that this exposure caused his leukemia, but that's based on two assumptions that I've made. I think you started to tell me that earlier, and I stopped you, so... That the exposure was significant.
Yes.
And the other thing? Well, wait a minute. That's a pretty big assumption. You know, assuming the moon is made of green cheese, it's my belief that the moon is made of green cheese. Well, given that assumption, well, that conclusion naturally follows. But you're assuming the thing that we were supposed to be getting some evidence about. So when the defendant points out this part of the deposition testimony, the trial judge says what? It's inadmissible, yeah. We can't present this to the jury. So what happened here? What's your guess as to what happened? It seems like a fairly major blunder on the part of the plaintiff. First of all, that the plaintiff, is offering this as the evidence on his exposure, doesn't have as a backup bringing this guy in the flesh to offer to be sworn in to amplify his opinion. Maybe he's got more to say about this, but it's not there in the cold record of the deposition. What do you think happened? Plaintiff's lawyer was asleep at the switch, didn't know what he was doing. Mr. Jones?
Well, it might be a case of he didn't want to bore the jury with endless talk about it.
He'd rather bore the jury than not get to the jury, and that's pretty much what happens here. He doesn't get to the jury because he can't prove this crucial element of the case that however negligent the defendant may have been, however much as a matter of law they're subject to strict liability, this key element showing that it caused the injury is missing. A plaintiff's lawyer tries to do things in as economical a fashion as possible. You don't want to bomb the village in order to save it. You know, if you spend $200,000 recovering $200,000, your client's not going to be very happy. A defendant, on the other hand, who spends $200,000 to avoid a $200,000 judgment, remember back in Bierman versus the City of New York, they're spending, a significant amount of money to try to keep Mrs. Bierman from recovering $300. And the defendant has a pretty big wallet. Sure, they don't want to spend any more money than they have to, but the plaintiff's working within a more restricted kind of situation. If you've seen a civil action or read the book, even better, you get a very good picture of how a good lawyer, second-rate lawyer by any means, a very good lawyer winds up miscalculating what it's going to cost him to finish the case. And the book opens up with his Porsche being towed away, repoed, because he's run out of money. Now, it may also be that he was expecting this doctor to show up, but the doctor, fell down and broke his leg, or the doctor otherwise became unavailable or something happened. Again, the vagaries of getting cases ready for trial. In a federal court, it's better, but even in a federal court, a schedule may get thrown off because there's a criminal case that was supposed to be done on Friday, and instead it's not finished and carries over to Monday and Tuesday, and therefore a trial that was supposed to start on Monday doesn't start till Wednesday. And then you can't simply say, doctor, you're going to be here Thursday afternoon, and you can arrange your schedule, cancel whatever appointments or you say, in a sense, doctor, I need you to be there when I need you to be there. And most people outside the legal profession find this, frankly, bizarre. In other walks of life, people make schedules and they keep to them, and they sort of acknowledge the value of other people's time. In the legal business, we say, well, the trial will start when the trial starts. So it's very difficult to schedule lay witnesses, expert witnesses. Judges and lawyers try to minimize the amount of inconvenience, but oftentimes it simply can't be done. So again, we're stuck in a situation in this case where the plaintiff doesn't have the goods. The goods would be, show me the evidence whereby a reasonable jury could conclude this exposure to this chemical produced this injury. It may seem like a sort of reasonable guess or speculation, but lots of things happen and then lots of other things happen, and it's not reasonable to simply say, because of this, then that. unless you have some evidence for it. Now, sometimes on the exam, you will simply have a factual question in which it's unclear if the defendant's negligence made a difference. And on that point, you will simply point out the fact that depending upon whether the jury believes that going 65 miles an hour instead of 60 miles an hour caused this injury in the sense that going 65 miles an hour, the defendant couldn't control the car. At 60 miles an hour, the defendant could have. The defendant having a blood alcohol content of 0.11 instead of 0.08 as the law places the limit, that caused the defendant to fail to recognize the situation in time to do something. Those factual questions are the ones the juries have to decide based on evidence. But one of the questions is by what standard we judge this, and that's the purpose of our next case, Reynolds versus the railroad company. Mr. Griffin, why don't you tell us about Reynolds?
Mr. Reynolds sued Texas Pacific Railway Company for damages to his working when she fell while she was getting out of the sitting room into the boarding train. The sitting room they were in before the train arrived was lit, whereas the area they were stepping into was dark at about 10 more. And witnesses testified the passengers were encouraged to hurry up by the train staff.
In terms of establishing the Chapter 1 issue about whether the defendant violated the standard of reasonable care, what's the plaintiff's case on that? What is it the defendant did that was negligent?
Didn't light the area well enough.
Okay, and in fact, I think there's some reference to there being a statute that requires, maybe there isn't, or maybe I'm imagining that. In any event, that's not the point of the dispute here. It's not whether the railroad was negligent in failing to have a light. The question is, what's the relationship between that lack of light and her fall? What happens at the trial of the case?
Judgment's on for plaintiffs.
Okay. Based upon... We got a judgment for the plaintiff, but is that because the judge rules as a matter of law the plaintiff's entitled to? I'm getting too technical here, but it's based on a jury verdict. So again, as I said in the first or second class, keeping track of the procedural stuff helps us to figure out what can the defendant complain about. If the judge had ruled as a matter of law that because the defendant was negligent, they're liable, the defendant might say, but wait a minute, we need to try the issue of proximate cause. Well, the issue of proximate cause was tried in this case. The jury was given the factual issue, and they ruled in favor of the plaintiff. Okay, let's suppose, for purposes of discussion, that there was testimony to this effect. First of all, the defendant's appeal is based on what issue?
I'm totally clear about it. It said that they were exempting liability for two grounds. They denied negligence.
Okay.
And then also, even conceding negligence, they denied it was fussed.
Okay. And again, I get a little fussy about use of the cause versus a cause. In this case, it wouldn't really make any difference, but it's kind of helpful to remember that the plaintiff's burden is to show it is a cause of the injury. All right. Let's suppose the railroad's lawyer cross-examines Mrs. Reynolds to this effect. Mrs. Reynolds, have you ever fallen before this incident? Yes. Say in the last 5 years. Can you recall for us how many times you've fallen? Three times. Okay, could you describe the first time? Okay, I was at a church picnic. I was carrying my food, and I didn't see a root that had come up out of the grass, and I tripped on it, and I fell down. What was the lighting like there, Mrs. Reynolds? Oh, it was bright sunshine. So even with good light, you fell that day. Isn't that correct? Yes. And tell me about the other time you fell. Well, I was going down to the basement to get some canned peaches, and one of the stairs had something on it, and I didn't see that, and I fell down the stairs. Oh. Well, what was the lighting like then? Well, I had the light on, and in fact, there was some daylight there. I could see perfectly well. But see, even though you could see perfectly well, you fell anyway. Isn't that correct, Mrs. Reynolds? Yes. Now, Mrs. Reynolds, as a matter of fact, on this occasion, when you fell down the stairs at the train station, you might have fallen anyway, even if there had been good light. She says, yes, I might have fallen anyway. Your Honor, I would move for a directed verdict, since she has acknowledged that we do not know in this case whether or not good lighting would have prevented her fall. What's the proper disposition of that motion for a directed verdict?
Mm-hmm. Can I ask a question?
Why?
You refer to here, this is mere the possibility that it would have happened without the negligence is not sufficient to break the chain of effect between, the cause and effect.
Okay, one of the things they talk about is the fact that the lack of light made it more likely. In a sense, it sort of borrows from the second half of this chapter, which is that part of causation is this idea that, or to go back to Tedler versus Ellman, it's sort of an efficient cause. It actually propels the action forward as opposed to being a mere occasion. Oh, it happened to be there, but it really didn't propel the action in the direction we're concerned about. But the other thing that the court points out is that the burden on Mrs. Reynolds is not to prove to a moral certainty this and only this caused her accident. The burden on her is to show more probably than not. Okay, so it might have happened anyway, even if the defendant hadn't been negligent. Yeah, that's true. So what? If there was a 40% chance that it would have happened anyway, but a 60% chance that it could have been avoided by good light, she wins. So again, one of the things you want to bear in mind is that when we're dealing with causation and we're trying to reconstruct the past, the burden is not to show, I know what would have happened if the defendant had used reasonable care. We don't have to get to that level of certainty. All we have to say is, more probably than not, the defendant's negligence made the difference between having this injury and avoiding this injury. So again, if you get leukemia after living in Woburn, Massachusetts, the scene of a civil action, and the plaintiff says, I think my husband got leukemia because of drinking the water that was tainted by the chemicals placed into the water stream by the defendants, with what level of certainty do we have to conclude that the chemicals caused this leukemia? Only by a standard more probable than not. Because there are lots of other things from which you can get leukemia, and it might be that the exposure to the chemicals didn't make any difference. We don't know that. But if we reach the conclusion, more probably than not, that it did, the plaintiffs met their burden. Okay, the next section goes into a whole series of legal exceptions. And I don't want you to miss the sort of simple version of causation because we spend so much time on the complex version of causation. It's a little bit like swatting a wasp as an example of the failure to use reasonable care. That's a sort of common everyday occurrence. True, there are lots of other exotic things that we can do, but some cases come down to an evaluation of whether a reasonable person would have swatted a wasp or not. In this case, deciding whether Mrs. Reynolds would have made it safely down the stairs if there had been adequate light is a relatively simple proposition. And if the jury reaches the conclusion that negligence caused her fall, we're done. The next series of cases deal with legal exceptions to the requirement, where the plaintiff can say, okay, I can't meet the traditional standard, but I want to be dispensed from that. I want a different rule to be applied. And as we'll see, in some cases, the plaintiff gets a different rule and benefits from an exception to the requirement of but-for cause. Mrs. Agajewski, is that the way you say your name? Why don't you tell us about Summers versus Tice? Damages here, and so the question before the house is whose shot caused the eye injury? What is the state of the plaintiff's evidence on this point? Yeah. What evidence can the plaintiff offer to tell us whether it was defendant one or defendant two that caused the eye injury? Yeah, the plaintiff doesn't have that. You don't have evidence that would distinguish which is which. Now, recalling the burden on the plaintiff, with respect to defendant one, who says, I'm not liable to the plaintiff unless the plaintiff, what's the test? Well, that's one burden. That's the chapter one burden. Let's assume the plaintiff can meet that burden, that defendant one was negligent, did something a reasonable person wouldn't have done. But the additional burden on the plaintiff is what? To what level of certainty? Beyond a reasonable doubt? That's the standard in a criminal case. We don't put O.J. Simpson in jail until we decide beyond a reasonable doubt he did what he's accused of doing. But for civil purposes, the standard is lower. What's the standard for a civil case like this one? Yes, it's merely to say, well, more probably than not. But the state of the evidence here is what? It's as likely to be one as the other. It's dead even. In a case where it's dead even, the plaintiff hasn't gone to that point of getting us over the mere, possibility. We haven't reached that level of confidence to say this one, rather than that one, more probably than not, caused the injury. So what does the plaintiff want us to do legally in light of the uncertainty of the evidence here?
Okay.
And in this respect, the legal doctrine we've already encountered, I would suspect, came to mind. We've already done something like this previously. The process of shifting the burden to the defendants to create a presumption that they're liable, that they have to talk their way out of, is like, yeah, it's like res ipsa. We're making an inference, or we're shifting the burden of proof here. Obviously, we've reversed what we know and what we don't know. In a res ipsa case, we know the defendant caused the injury, and we're guessing that there was negligence. Here, we know the defendant was negligent, and we're guessing that the defendant caused the injury. It's just switch here. Does the court buy that argument that we ought to shift the burden of proof to the defendants? Yeah. In this case, it's fair to say to the defendants, in effect, you explain to us which one caused the injury. And again, there may be evidence the defendants would have to say, well, I was at this angle. Where was the plaintiff facing? Was the plaintiff facing this way, such that it seems more likely that a shot from this direction would have struck the plaintiff in the eye? Coming from this direction, the shot would have, you know, gone more in a different direction. Again, slight differences in angle would lead us to say, well, it's more probable that it was this one than that one. The point is, we put the burden on the defendant. If after we listen to the defendants, there's no clear distinction, we find they remain equally likely to have caused the injury, what happens? What's the procedural effect of a jury coming back saying, we don't know which one caused the injury? Yes, then they're both held liable. Again, if we didn't shift the burden and the jury came back and said, we find them both equally likely to have caused the injury, the plaintiff would have failed in his burden of proof. So, again, this theory, you need to ask somebody to clean this out so that it's okay. This is called alternative liability, or the rule of Summers versus Tice. Alternative liability, meaning it's essentially liability in the alternative. It's either this defendant or that defendant, but we're not going to wind up saying, because we don't know, it's none of the above. What are the requirements to prove this? And again, this looks very much like res ipsa from the standpoint that to get this dispensation from the normal rule, the plaintiff's got to present the basis for it, the legal basis for it. And what is the legal basis? I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear that. Okay, so the first part of it essentially is, we know the defendants breached a duty toward the plaintiff. So all of the defendants essentially are found negligent. In this case, not exercising good judgment in keeping track, I guess part of the expectation of people who were hunting, I think there's some reference to this, that they were supposed to stay in line, so that instead of getting into this triangular arrangement, you're supposed to make sure that the that the guys I'm hunting with are parallel or, you know, sort of in a straight line here. Nobody's offside, so to speak. If they fail to do that, they're not exercising reasonable care. So both of these hunters were firing their guns without making sure that all the hunters were essentially behind the line of fire. Okay, what else do we need to know? Well, there would be another way to serve a little bit of an aside. It kind of gets into Sindel. Sindel raises these other forms of liability. One of the other forms of liability for causation would be concert of action. That doesn't apply here, but despite the fact that there is no concert of action, we can apply alternative liability if all the defendants are negligent. Rubio?
If there's no third party that some other hunters in the area could have shot them?
Well, let's put this in a more positive form that, this is a little abstract, the person causing the injury is among the defendants. That is, as you say, we know that this is not just a possible cause. One of these hunters fired the bullet that hit the plaintiff. So when we impose liability on this group, we know that within this group is the person who caused the injury. And essentially, as a corollary, all of the defendants are in the courtroom. I'm not saying this very well. We'll get a better statement of it in Sindel. But again, the concept here is we've narrowed the field to the people who may have caused the injury. Among them is the tortfeasor who caused the injury. We're going to shift the burden to them. Talk their way out of it. And again, Summers versus Tice is a classic example. It's one of the examples used in the restatement. And it's sort of this image of how the principle of alternative liability will be applied. They're all negligent. One of them caused the injury. We shift the burden to them to talk their way out of it. Mr. Stubbs. Yeah, pretty much. As I said, I'm not saying this very well. We're struggling here to identify what it is that we're a better way to say number three really is let's move on to Sindel. Brain's a little dead for the moment here, and I'll get it here. Trust me. Okay, Sindel. Yes, Mr. Yeah, please.
What's the significance in the defendant's ability to absolve
himself? It has to do with the courts. It's a little bit like res ipsa, and it's reminiscent of the exam question in that there's sort of a missing evidence or gap in the evidence problem. That's what triggers res ipsa. That's what triggers alternative liability. Somehow it's fair that the plaintiff asks for a shift in the burden of proof because the defendant has better access to the information than the plaintiff does. So So although that's not explicitly stated as a requirement for alternative liability, in practice, the courts choose to impose alternative liability as a policy matter where they can fairly say to the defendants, look, you're the one with better access to information. You, rather than the plaintiff, should bear this burden. Okay, so let's talk about Sindel. Sindel is kind of this, you know, bottomless pit of, legal discussion, but wrapped up in one case is a whole bunch of information about exceptions to the but-for cause requirement, at least with respect to failure to identify the defendant. So bears considerable study because you'll find lots of good information, and these all are contrasted so that you can distinguish them one from the other. Mr. Trujillo, can you tell us about Sindel? Okay. Mr. McBride, why don't you tell us about Sindel?
Thank you for putting it down because the student alone the molecule of the drug DES is shown to be the cancer.
Okay, and again, there's sort of a factual puzzle here. For one thing, apparently, this drug has no effect upon actually preventing miscarriage. So it's not as though, well, gee, the plaintiffs in some sense owe their existence to this drug and now they're blaming it. No, as a matter of fact, the plaintiffs would have been better off if their mothers had never taken this drug. And it has these side effects of essentially exposing being a carcinogenic substance that causes cancer in some and requires the other people who find out that their mothers took this drug, it requires these women to monitor their health and so forth. Okay, so now the question is, how does the plaintiff identify the defendant among the many manufacturers of this drug who caused her injury? Yeah, and she can't. She lacks the evidence. She's trying to reconstruct. She discovers, let's say, at the age of 22 or 25 or 17 or some age when she experiences the medical symptoms associated with DES, and her doctor says, is your mother still alive? Yes. Can you talk to her or can I talk to her and find out, did you take a drug while you were pregnant to try to prevent miscarriage? Yes, as a matter of fact, in some cases, the daughter knows, but then you ask the mother, well, do you remember the brand of the drug that you took, 25 years ago? Well, no, I don't. So the question is, well, now what? Can the plaintiff sue all of the manufacturers of DES and do some kind of exception to the but-for cause requirement in order to get a recovery? And as I said before, the plaintiff actually has a variety of different sort of classic litigation strategy. Sometimes referred to as having a number of arrows in your quiver. You pull out an arrow and shoot it at the target. If it hits, you win. But if you miss, you just pull another arrow out and keep firing. And the first arrow that the plaintiff fires away at is what?
The burden of proof.
So the first argument is that this case is like Summers versus Tice. In what respect is it like Summers versus Tice?
More than one defendant and there's no
Okay, but on the positive side, what can the plaintiff offer by way of proof that matches the level of proof that was found sufficient in Summers versus Tyson? There are things the plaintiff does have to prove. What did the plaintiff prove in Summers versus Tice? Yes. In, you know, sort of by analogy, the defendants weren't firing their guns, but they were launching this product into the stream of commerce. And the argument that the plaintiff offers is all of them were negligent in failing to test this drug adequately or do other steps that would have revealed its potentially harmful side effects and then to warn people about this potential. So the argument is that all of these manufacturers who sold DES failed to use reasonable care. So far, so good. Ms. Woodruff. I don't think with respect to the risk of cancer, nobody knew about the risk of cancer.
It was an experimental drug then?
Yeah, and I believe diethylstilbestrol is a hormone, actually, and I think this hormone still does have medical uses. It's just one of the medical uses is not trying to prevent miscarriage. So, again, part of the later medical knowledge is it doesn't do any good and it does a lot of harm.
So if they just drug knowing that it was, as you said, it was just like a drug that was under experimental drug, that is just a good enough warning that it's, that therefore you're not going to be, you can't be held liable for anything other than it's just experimental.
Well, let me back up for a second to sort of address the larger question of what we do with experimental drugs. Actually, there's a second half to this case that shows up in Chapter 9 on product liability, because one of the issues goes back, in effect, to the sort of chapter, it's not really a Chapter 1 issue anymore, because we've gone beyond the world of negligence. That's why it shows up in Chapter 9. It's under the idea of product liability. What is our standard for holding, for saying that a product is defective? How does that apply to things like experimental drugs? Now, what this raises is sort of a larger policy issue, is what's the relative role of the Food and Drug Administration, our government regulatory body representing us, in deciding either to approve or not approve a drug for use by the medical profession. And it actually raises a difficult policy question of the extent to which you want the tort system, on the one hand, essentially a kind of entrepreneurial, you take the risk, you stand to benefit, but you also bear the potential liability, as compared to a government regulatory system which says you can do this, you can't do this. If you do what the government says you can do, you are in a safe harbor. If you violate what the government says, then you're in trouble. How do these two systems kind of relate? The way they relate right now, for the most part, is that compliance with government regulations is a necessary but not a sufficient condition to avoid liability. You can still be held liable for failing to use reasonable care even though the FDA approved your drug. Some people would argue, not the Trial Lawyers Association, but some people would argue that we're essentially spending all this money to chase down horses after they've gotten out of the barn, and all the money that's spent on the tort system would be better spent closing the barn doors. Let's put that into the research before a drug is released so that you know, we prevent injuries rather than giving people compensation after the injuries have occurred. The trial lawyer's answer to that, in effect, is right. You know, we're going to have, you know, your safety will now be in the hands of the same kind of people who screen your luggage at the airport. You know? I mean, wouldn't you rather have, you know, ironically in this sense, although the Trial Lawyers Association tends to be viewed as being on the liberal end of the political spectrum, it's a much more entrepreneurial sort of free market approach as opposed to one, the dirigisme, as the French would say, of an economic model in which you have essentially government-driven standards. So again, there's this whole kind of system-wide question about, and it's endemic throughout the tort system, the safety of airlines. Do we want the FAA determining thumbs up or thumbs down? And once they've determined that an airplane is airworthy, the design is no longer open to criticism? Or do we want people to have the freedom after we found out what's wrong with it to say, well, maybe the FAA approved it, but a reasonable person would not have put this thing on the market? What about automobile design, the National Highway Transportation and Safety Administration, whether airbags are required or not? Again, how does the tort system and its liability rules interact with a governmental regulatory system which requires some things but not others? So you could ask the question about the FDA. Would it be better that the FDA's permitting this drug to be used on an experimental basis would essentially say, now everybody use it at your peril? Or would we rather have a system in which we say to the drug companies, go ahead and sell this, but after all, you take the risk, you stand to benefit from it after all, you make profits on successful drugs, you simultaneously take the risk that one of them will turn out to be a bad drug. Will create liability. Again, the question about liability will be postponed until Chapter 9. In Chapter 9, after we've looked at more generally at product liability, we look at the specific problem of how to deal with drugs, and we come back to this very same case. It's actually Brown versus Brown versus Superior Court by that time. But meanwhile, back at the ranch here, we're looking at causation questions. With respect to alternative liability, we can allege that all the defendants were negligent. What's the problem in using alternative liability? She's not dealing from a full deck here. She can't name all the manufacturers of DES. Why not?
Some are the business of all.
Yeah, it turns out there are more than 100 of them, depending on how you count it and who's so forth. But it's in fact, these cases, it was sort of a lawyer's full employment act. When this class action was brought, the defendants and their insurance companies, I think they rented out a high school gymnasium for all the lawyers and their, you know, clients, so that the, you know, just the manufacturers and their insurance companies and their lawyers, I mean, you walk into that room and you see the meters turning, you know. But how else do you do this? Each defendant, each manufacturer, again, what the plaintiff's hoping for is that somewhere in this room of whirling meters, there is a potential recovery. Okay, so alternative liability doesn't work because we fail that requirement that all of the potential causes of this accident are within the courtroom subject to potential liability. If we're missing some, we don't have the right to impose this rule of alternative liability. Mr. Gordon?
Yeah.
It's my understanding that the main reason they excluded the jury is because the defendants didn't have greater access to the information of causation from the plaintiff there, which is one of the main things they were concerned
about. Well, that sort of the question about whether the defendant has greater access to the information serves as kind of a tipping function here. When other things are evenly balanced, the fact that the defendant has better access to it may tip us over in that direction. The fact that the defendant doesn't have access to it may lead us to refuse to impose it. But I think the more basic problem here, from the standpoint that we've already identified one of the requirements in Summers versus Tice, the reason we could do it in Summers versus Tice, by turning it over to the defendants and say, you work out amongst yourselves which of you caused this injury, start pointing the finger at one another, and bring out the evidence, well, I was facing in the other direction, or I was too far away, I don't think I could have hit him, etc., is that somewhere in there, the person who caused the injury will be found. If we lack that confidence, if the person who caused the injury may very well not be among the players that we've got in this drama, then the rationale for doing alternative liability falls apart. Yeah?
Before you even get there, to that point, that they all need to be in the room, then you have to first start with the racist theory that
Again, race ups are by analogy here. The sort of notion that the defendants have better. Now, I think there's a question. There are two questions. One is whether the person who caused the injury is among the defendants. The second question is which of the defendants caused the injury. Now, if the defendants have better access to which of the defendants caused the injury, there may be, you know, a lot of dispute about who did or who didn't, but we may have relative confidence. We may know that all of the defendants who caused the injury are or are not, all the defendants who might have caused the injury are or are not amongst us. Suppose, for example, going back to Summers versus Tice, again, Summers versus Tice is an easy case because there are only two guys out there with shotguns firing away. We hear no other shots. We can be certain beyond a reasonable doubt that the bullet or the shotgun pellet that took this guy's eye out came from one of the two of them. By contrast, in the DES cases, depending on how you count the numbers, we can be pretty certain that the defendants are not an inclusive or complete list of the people who supply DES. Now, we'll talk later on about the difficulty of actually, the court winds up relying upon some calculation of the defendant's market share. So let's just take a hypothetical that the plaintiff that we're concerned about her mother was living in Spokane at the time she took this drug, and the daughter then was exposed to this chemical. Assuming that it happened in Spokane, and we have some evidence from the mother, yes, we were living on the South Hill at the time. I did most of my shopping at the Rose Hours. That's where I filled most of my prescriptions. Occasionally, if it was, 2 in the morning, I'd have to go downtown to this all-night pharmacy down there. But most of my prescriptions were filled at the Rose Hours on 29th Avenue. Oh, okay. Now we could begin to figure out of the, you try to reconstruct what are the relative market shares of the DES that was sold from that pharmacy. Perhaps Rose Hours had a deal with Park Davis or with you know, Eli Lilly or with Merck or with some, you know, drug company that supplied most of their generic prescription. You know, if they got a prescription for DES, they filled it using this particular brand. That would help. We might also look to, for example, you know, how much Merck or Eli Lilly or, you know, Park Davis, how much of their market share was sold in the Pacific Northwest or in Spokane in particular. How much of it was sold to, you know, individual freestanding drugstores as opposed to drugstores that were part of a grocery chain. As it turns out, the nightmare of determining market share could take you weeks. You could argue over what methodology to use to calculate market share. And maybe the mother has some recollection. Yeah, I remember the drug gave, the doctor prescribed something for miscarriage, and it was in the form of a gel cap, or it was a liquid that I took, or it was something I had to grind up and stir into my orange juice. Well, knowing that would limit, okay, there's certain of the manufacturers that fit that description. Then we would say, okay, for the people who sold it in a liquid form, we have this group of manufacturers. And some would say, I never sold it in that form, take me out of this lawsuit. So even though the theory here of market share winds up being one that persuades the court, practically speaking, it would be a nightmare to enforce. Why don't we take a 10-minute break and we'll come back and pick that up.
I have a quick announcement. If you'll take one of these handouts, I'm going to do a tutorial at 1:15 to 1:30. We won't be over 15 minutes. So I'm talking to talk. Thank you.
Sure.
This is my grandson, Damien.